This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello from Brandeis University. Welcome to Recall This Book, where the crack anthropologist Elizabeth Ferry and I, oh no, that sounds like you study crack, but the star anthropologist Elizabeth Ferry and I'm John Plotz, assemble scholars and writers from different disciplines to make sense of contemporary issues, problems, and events. Today, we tackle the always contemporary question of fantasy, its appeal to children and adults, its power to make up other worlds, and what that power has to do with our imaginative capacity to make our own world anew. So very tiny topic, but luckily to take it on, we have the giant brain of Edinburgh professor Anna Vinitskaya. So welcome, Anna. It is great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So many things can be credited to Anna's giant brain, including in recent years, an amazing archive called Scotland, Russia, Cultural Encounter Since 1900, which I'm sorry, we will not probably talk about today, though I think it's fascinating. But specifically, we asked Anna here to walk around fantasy with us because she's the author both of William Morris and the Idea of Community, Romance, History, and Propaganda, 1880 to 1914, that was published in 2010, and Fantasies of Time and Death, Dunsany, Edison, Tolkien, which was published in 2020. So Anna, one thing I really, really like about your work is the way it traces the lineage that includes famous names like our shared hero, socialist William Morris, and of course, Tolkien, but is also mindful of lesser lights like Mervyn Peake, Lord Dunsany, Edith Nesbitt, Stella Benson maybe, and Hope Merlisse, Arthur Machen, and a host of others. And I hope that we could sort of extend that genealogy forward to heroes of our own childhood, like say Susan Cooper and Edward Eger. But all of that points, I think, to an RTB special, which means it's not so much an author interview as it is a three-way conversation about fantasy, which grows from your published work, but is not reliant on that exclusively. But so having said that, Anna, can I maybe ask you just to kick us off by telling us about your most recent book, Fantasies of Time and Death, and we'll sort of go onward from there.
Sure. Well, I'll begin actually by giving a personal story. I was a Tolkien fan as a child, and I have to say I'm still one today.
Good.
And
too.
What attracted me to his work as a child was not the adventure, the fun, the excitement that so many people tend to find in it, but the feeling of melancholy, loss, and sometimes even despair. These feelings, I began, as everyone does, with The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and then progressed on to the rest of his legendarium. And one of the reasons why I was attracted to this aspect of his work was rooted in my own life journey, as it were, as somebody who emigrated at a young age. And I found when reading about Tolkien's elves that their longing for a lost home, their sense of displacement and exile was something I could identify with. So here's a wonderful example of a work of fantasy that has a direct bearing on real life experiences of so many human beings in our world today, but also, of course, throughout history. And connected with this overwhelming sense of melancholy and nostalgia was a meditation on the passage of time, of course, the things that time takes us away from in our own lives and in history more generally, the things we lose as a culture as time passes. And of course, for Tolkien, the question of death, as he himself said, was absolutely central. And I latched on to this even as a child before I began to consider it analytically, as yeah. it were, later in life.
Can I jump in on that? That point about death is so fascinating, especially as a child reader, because I completely understand what you're talking about with that feel of nostalgia and loss. But it, and maybe this is where you were going, it brings up the issue of the immortality of the elves. Mm-hmm. So I wondered, I wondered your thoughts about nostalgia.
Yeah.
Among the immortals, yeah.
The elves' nostalgia, or the nostalgia of the immortals, as you say, is rooted precisely in the fact that they have to keep living after they have lost that which they have loved. And this is something that you get in The Lord of the Rings, of course, but also across Tolkien's legendarium. And it's precisely, ironically, because their lives are so long, endless as far as the duration of this physical world is concerned, that the burdens they have to bear are so much more profound and more poignant in the context of the imagined world than the burdens of mortal beings like human beings, because mortals, they have to fear death, which comes quickly to them, but they don't have to deal with the accumulating losses that the elves accrued over their lifetime, their endless mm-hmm. lifetimes.
I wanted to say that I love that we dived right into Tolkien, right. but I think it's, but it's just fascinating to think about that particularity of Tolkien's struggle with like nostalgia, as you put it, Anna, but also sort of the immortal perfect world versus the broken ruined world that we actually live in. I mean, you're making me think, I think, in, you know, you guys probably know I'm obsessed with Ursula Le Guin, and the scale, the time scale in Le Guin, the dragons live on right. that other time scale. Yeah. And then there's a kind of interface between the dragon and the human. And just to scale outward maximally, can I ask, Anna, have you thought about the analogy to very, very old epic forms that we might or might not call fantasy, like the Iliad and the Odyssey, where mm-hmm. the gods are kind of coterminous with the humans. They somewhat envy the humans for being mortal, but they mm-hmm. kind of struggle with the burden that they're immortal and therefore their actions are kind of light, whereas humans are mortal and their actions are heavy, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there. If you look at various pagan pantheons, quote unquote, it is interesting to observe this kind of thing. Obviously, to say just one more thing about Tolkien,
sure.
in his instance, it's the Norse pantheon that's most relevant and as an inspiration and so on, although it was by no means limited to that. And the idea of the doom of the gods, that the gods ultimately will also have to will also be defeated in the end, is something that you can see entering into his own sub-creation. And to maybe bring this back to the subject of my book as well, Tolkien was by no means the only early fantasist, and I call him early because, of course, much of what he was writing, we think of The Lord of the Rings as a mid-20th century work, but in actual fact, it's really more early 20th century. And at that time, there were others like Lord Dunsany, like E.R. Edison, who are the other two authors that I consider in my monograph, who were exploring this idea of what the gods' relationship is to human existence, to existence in general. They were producing these thought experiments, what it must be like as an immortal being who is not just immortal like an elf living in this physical world and bound by its constraints, but actually is, you know, transcends the world, can create the world, can destroy the world, and so on. What it must be like for a being like that, that has on the one hand, immense powers, but on the other hand, is also subject to constraints of a different kind on their nature, and what the relationship is between these sort of divine beings and the creatures they create, whether those be mortal or immortal. So these kinds of questions were ones that various fantasy authors were engaging with in the early 20th century, and obviously since then as well. So any author who creates a simulacrum of reality is sub-creating, but in the case of a fantasist, they've introduced aspects into that sub-created secondary world that are not present in the primary world where we actually live. And this is what makes things interesting in the fantasy.
Like magic animals exactly. that talk or...
Yeah, any like kind of supernatural element, essentially. Mm-hmm. Now, just one note on that prefix sub in sub-creation. The reason Tolkien thought of it as sub-creation is, of course, because he was a Christian believer, and he thought the ultimate creator is God, and therefore we human beings who are made in God's image also create like our creator. So we are, as it were, mini gods, if you will, who make because we're made in the image of the maker. Ultimately, again, as a Catholic, he thought that our sub-creations will be given life by God, will be turned into real creation, into a part of reality at some point after humankind is redeemed. So that's his particular kind of Christian take on it. It's not original to him. If you read the essays of George MacDonald, who was a Victorian fantasist writing sort of in the second half of the 19th century, and his essays on the imagination, he pretty much says the same thing. And there are others as well. So the MacDonald was a Congregationalist minister whose ideas were deeply rooted in his Christian belief as well. So there's this tradition within fantasy writing, which theorizes the purpose of the fantasy writer as a kind of almost instrument. Well, not an instrument, that sounds too kind of grand, but not as an instrument of God, but as somebody who effectively on a human scale does what God does. Now, obviously, if you do not subscribe to that particular system of faith, then this won't work for you as an explanation of what fantasy writers do. But certain aspects of it can certainly be taken and can be made useful, whatever one's particular background is. Mm-hmm. And the idea that any writer creates a world when they... Right. I think no one would argue with that. That's a fairly self-explanatory...
I was thinking that the very term world building, and when people talk, and they often talk about it in the context of worlds that don't follow the same rules as our everyday worlds, that already is implied, maybe not a divine creator, but some sort of process of creation that looks a lot like that, right?
Yeah, but it's completely fascinating to know. I had missed this, and I guess it's in On Fairy Stories that Tolkien believed that after human existence, that those worlds would actually somehow be realized. That's amazing.
The hope, as he, it's in the epilogue to the Essay on Fairy Stories that people don't tend to focus on. But that's pretty much what he says there. And I think most critics don't go there because it's just a bit too far for.
Well, but it's I mean, it's interesting. We don't really need to talk about the kind of tension between Lewis and Tolkien, but that's an interesting. Like, I always assumed that one of the things that Tolkien didn't like about Lewis was his insistence on that kind of eschatological realization at the end of the Narnia books, where you get the kind of world beyond, you know, worlds beyond worlds that are realized after death.
But in actual fact, I mean, I don't think, because they were both talking about these things in these very same years Tolkien's composing the essay. So it's not surprising, I think.
Can I ask a not very well-informed question about Lewis and Tolkien? My reading of Lewis was always, and I think I may have even learned the word allegory in the context of reading Lewis, and I know that that's not totally technically accurate, but there is more of an allegorical feeling, I think, when you read it, that, you know, this is an allegory of sort of Christianity, whereas I would never say that Tolkien is an allegory.
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Okay. Yeah. And Tolkien says that himself explicitly, like in one of those prefaces, later prefaces to Lord of the Rings, he makes this great distinction between allegory and applicability, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And he disliked, as is well known, Lewis's penchant for allegory. That said, Tolkien himself did write allegories. He has a couple of short stories, Leaf by Niggle and Smith of Wootton Major, that arguably, but I think no one would seriously disagree that they are allegories. So he practiced in that form too, but it was not his favorite by any means.
Yeah.
This raises an interesting, bigger question about the degree to which fantasy in general is susceptible to, not just allegorical interpretations, but to the impulse towards allegory. Do fantasy writers, because if we go beyond somebody like C.S. Lewis, everyone knows about Narnia as an allegory. How much allegory, quote unquote, can be found in other types of fantasies? And if I may bring in one of the authors that wrote my book about, E.R. Edison, who is not well known, he's very difficult to read. That may be one reason why very few people read him, but I think very rewarding once you get a hold of him. Also very ideologically problematic, and that's something maybe if we talk about Morris later on, we can talk about
ideology. I think that'd be great to talk about, actually. Yeah.
But just to say that Edison was very interested in this question of allegory as well. He hated it. He built a whole philosophical system on the basis of the significance of particularity and sort of the irreducibility of things. Here was another fantasy writer who was repudiating allegory as a mode, very, very consciously and explicitly.
Maybe we could connect that to the ideological uptake question that you mentioned. And I guess the way I was thinking about this, but Anna, you should take the question any way you want. But I was thinking that there are tendencies in even in what you've been saying. But if we think about how somebody like Tolkien works to subcreate, there's tendencies to imagine that as affirming a kind of possibility of a stable world order, which you could think of as conservative by nature. I mean, whether it's redemptively Christian or just sort of a kind of reinforcing the stable facticity of like a story frame that holds. And then there's another way in which, because subcreation or secondary world making is reimagining, it would be consistent, you know, with the sort of claims that Ursula Le Guin makes, you know, that there's a manifesto for reimagining the world built into fantasy. Like that is that fantasy, there's one reading of fantasy that says people are escapists. Like Frederick Jameson says, fantasy is escapism. Mm-hmm. It's just idle wish fulfillment. And that would make it look more ideologically either neutral or conservative. And then there's another vision that says, well, no, it's actually showing you a way out. Ergo, it's emancipatory, it's progressive, it's anarchist, however you want to talk about it. Which angles make sense to you and why?
Well, all of them together, as it were, because it's we haven't touched on the thorny issue of defining what fantasy actually is, and I don't suggest we go that way because that's a rabbit hole. But because so many different things have been called fantasy, I think it is actually impossible to generalize. The certain works that we call fantasy fit into the former kind of, and certain fit into the latter. I know, for instance, a recent book by James Gifford on fantasy and the radical fantastic and modernism, anarchism and fantasy. Yeah. He has chapters devoted to Dunsany and Merleys and so on, and Morris, and as well as obviously later fantasists. Yeah. But there have been readings of the same authors that have taken both tacks, as it were. So it's possible to read even the same work from opposite points of view as on the one hand transformative, but if looked at from a different angle, which you could call conservative. Even Tolkien, who is nobody would argue, I think, that he's particularly radical, ideologically speaking. But if you actually look at his definition of escapism in On Fairy Stories as something that that makes us want to revolt against the abuses of the status quo, and he talks specifically about factories producing bombs in that essay. He gives that as a concrete example. Obviously, he also talks about the internal combustion engine and sort of, you know, industry and all the rest of it, which is his better known conservative side, if you will. But he frames fantastic escapism as a statement against war in the essay on Fairy Stories. So as a kind of call to reimagine the world in a radical way that condemns the sort of the abuses of human society, the destruction of human life, and so on. So that you could easily read that as quote unquote radical if you wished to do so. So I think it's all about how we define these terms, I think, ultimately. But if we step back into a more narrow definition, where we're literally looking at the political views of a given fantasy author, then things are relatively simple. And we can take someone like William Morris, who was a Victorian writer of fantasy, but also one of the founders of British socialism, and in his later years, which is when most of his fantasy romances were written, he was active he was an active Marxist. So he infused his fantasy with ideas about, for instance, communitarian ways of living, about the importance of solidarity, all of those kinds of things, kind of values. They're there to be seen, but the romances aren't allegories, so we don't have a kind of crude embodiment of his political ideas in those stories. They work on their own terms. They exist completely outside of any ideological framework, should you wish to read them that way. But equally, if you wish to place them back in the political context of the time, they make sense in relation to Morris's own political beliefs.
Which may explain why News from Nowhere and The Dream of John Ball, say, are more sort of widely cited works than those works.
Yes, exactly.
Because they lend themselves to more direct.
Exactly. Yeah. Because he's explicit there, because News from Nowhere is a straightforward socialist utopia. And, you know, the label's right there. I mean, aside from fantasy, one of my main research areas is the sort of the history of the British socialist movement. And in the 19th century, the socialists, and I'm referring here not just to writers, but to sort of the activists, political activists, and so on, they used the past very, very actively in order to formulate their critique of the present. So they were able to critique the capitalist status quo by invoking certain models, sometimes inventing the past in a way that suited their particular agenda, in order to show that, look, things can be different because in the past they weren't like this. They can be different again. And the past might actually give us some examples of how to structure our societies that we could use to make the future a better one.
And that was sort of what I meant by the Morris analogy. Terms of this, that's the other side of my argument about why transformation and preservation don't seem to align in a neat way, according to a political spectrum, because they're, as you put it beautifully, the past and the future is what you make of it, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So we have a conversation with Gifford in the vault that we're going to publish one of these days about right. radicalism and Le Guin. But mm-hmm. also we have an upcoming conversation with David Wengrow, who wrote that book, The Dawn of Everything. Do you know this book? It's not, he wrote it with Graeber.
He wrote it with David Graeber.
Passed away, oh. David Graeber. Yeah.
Oh, yes, of course I do. Yeah. I was thinking of Graeber as the main author.
So Wengrow is the archaeologist who worked with Graeber. And one of the things I love about that book is that it basically just shows the insane variety of like economic and political dispensations mm-hmm. under which so-called quote prehistoric human society has endure, you know, there's not one teleology. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, exactly. Like a multifoliate version of how you articulate basically power, knowledge, authority, you know, like all of these different variables that can be combined in many different ways. And mm-hmm. yeah, so I totally take that fantasy can be regressively backward looking, but I like the notion that it is it looks outward, and by looking outward, it has the potential to just shake things up, which might be a reversion to some older imagined better order. But Anna, what you're saying, I completely agree with, which is that like the imaginary past can be a different future too.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
So we haven't really talked about the children's fantasy side or the children versus adult. I mean, we've been assuming a sort of continuous, and Anna, you started us off with that beautiful anecdote about your own, you know, like feeling that sense of loss and nostalgia that it sounds like pervades even your adult account of Tolkien as well. But mm-hmm. do we want to think a little bit about the notion of these as books for children versus what it means to be an adult? Like as an adult reader of fantasy, are you an outside reader always or sort of a secondary reader?
So I wouldn't class Tolkien's writing, except for the obviously children-oriented Hobbit and several of his shorter stories. He is not a writer for children, although he is accessible to children. And I think that's what wrongfoots some people, that when they come across a work that is not inaccessible, and obviously there are all the marketing considerations and sort of critical disparagement that greeted the publication of the book and that has persisted in certain quarters since. So even leaving all of that aside, I think we shouldn't class something as a quote-unquote children's book in that negative sense if it can be read by children, because it can also be read by adults just as well. And as Tolkien himself said in the Essay on Fairy Stories, and I apologize for constantly coming back to that, adults will get more out of it. Children can read it and enjoy it, but adults will get so much more. Mm-hmm. And that is a hallmark of all children's fantasy that is actually intentionally targeted at children as well. If it's well written, adults will be able to glean more from it than children could possibly do. That's both for the good and for the bad, because if we take someone like Edith Nesbit, who is a well-known children's fantasy writer from the late 19th, early 20th century. And incidentally, also, she was a socialist member of the Fabian Society, so on the kind of radical end, if you will, politically. Those books are, they're urban comic fantasies for the most part. They're very enjoyable reads. My own daughter sort of really loves them. But then when I look at them as an adult reader with a kind of contextual knowledge and so on, I actually find a lot of ideologically, politically, if you will, disturbing elements in them in relation to depictions of class, to, you know, race, even to a certain extent, gender.
yeah.
and so on, which a child would simply not pick up on because they lack the reference points of the background.
I have a question. I mean, something like E. Nesbitt, it makes sense that it's written for children because it has children protagonists, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, although I certainly, in many ways, more accessible, The Hobbit, I think it's, I like it much better than The Lord of the Rings, than The Fellowship.
Oh, those are fighting words, dude.
I know, really? But as you can see, and I'm willing to fight if I need to, but what makes it obviously for children in your sense?
Right. I think actually I was thinking in terms of origins because it began as a story for one of his own children and was famously the publisher's reader for it was famously the publisher's son, 11-year-old, I think, son at the time. So so in that sense, in terms of its gestation and publication, it was always framed that way. It was obviously published as a children's book. But you're right in that if you look at it simply as a text in its own right, actually that's true. I mean, what aspects of it would make us classified as a children's book, I'm not so sure in that instance. Mm-hmm. So that's actually
a good question. Definitely less dark than the rest of the, you know, than the Ring Cycle anyways.
I don't know. I'm going to say, I love The Hobbit. I was read it as a child. I read it to my children with great pleasure. I have read it as an adult with pleasure. But I think the There and Back Again structure is pretty classic children's story. I mean, it has a quest with, you know, various people who loom into view as, you know, obstacles or episodes for the unfolding experience of a single, you know, small, somewhat childlike figure, I think. I mean, he might be old, but he is, you know, ingenuous.
Yeah,
sure.
And Lord of the Rings is different from that. Like Lord of the Rings just, it demands a complexity of world rendition. It's not just the unfolding of a line. It's like looking laterally and seeing the whole map.
But this also raises the question of different target audiences and whether there's such a thing, for instance, as young adult fiction, mm-hmm. because that's a marketing category which has limited usefulness, I think, as a critical category. But nevertheless,
A Wizard of Earthsea was commissioned to be a young adult book.
That's in fact exactly what I was going to bring up right now is The Wizard of Earthsea, because in that instance, it's precisely the label, sort of, it's made to the label, and the protagonist is the protagonists rather, because they're Sparrowhawk and Aaron and so on, the boy protagonists, they're sort of on the cusp of manhood, so they're adolescents, and the story is about their crossing over that line into adulthood, so their initiation, mm-hmm. if you will. And there's
a school story at the beginning,
with Roke, absolutely, so they're all those hallmarks. So that's an interesting, but then of course it goes beyond that. And obviously when Le Guin continued the series into Tehanu kind of and onwards, at that point, I think it sheds its young adult associations almost completely. And if, you know, especially, you know, if you think about the Tehanu to such an extent about the life of the middle aged, those classifications begin to creak and fall apart, basically, the more it develops. So I think, and that's a hallmark for me of, you know, that's what good fiction should do. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't remain imprisoned by any kind of categories that might be imposed upon it.
Generic categories, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that raises a whole nother angle, which we probably don't have a ton of time left to explore. But it is one of the things, now that I think back to Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, he's very definite that the genre is a textual one by nature, or the mode is textual by nature. And that's a funny claim. I mean, it's a very apropos claim at the era that he made it. But if you think about how fantasy has permeated our different media forms nowadays. And I don't know if you guys have seen the trailer for the new Lord of the Rings, which I suppose is like the Silmarillion forthcoming. Yeah. But, you know, obviously the incredible success of the Lord of the Ring movies, but other, you know, versions as well. You know, we could ask that question of whether fantasy looks fundamentally different in a textual form from a, I don't know, visual, you know, or what's a word for all of those different media modes, you know, popular media, I guess. Film, TV, et cetera.
Yeah, I think nowadays one cannot talk about fantasy as an exclusively textual form, but those days are long gone. And if you look at the conferences, book sort of essay collections, everything, it's multimodal, and there are probably more people working on fantasy in those other modes than there are working on textual fantasy nowadays. That's just a guess, but this impression I get. But I think they do differ. So the films, fantasy films, would come the closest, I think, to textual fantasy because there is a single, well, to a certain extent, the single author's guiding vision determining the whole product, the whole sort of final output. Although obviously, unlike a book, there are lots of other people involved in the creation of cinematic fantasy, but usually there's still a director who stamps their vision on the world. But once you get into gaming, for instance, then even that goes by the wayside, and there's so much agency is given to the player, for instance, in navigating their way around the world and choosing, sort of learning about it, doing different things in it. And the worlds are constantly being expanded. If they're successful game worlds, for instance, then they're potentially endless in the way that even something like the lifelong project of a Tolkien or some other authors who've done that kind of thing, they can't possibly compete because they're still just one person at the end of the day and that one person is going to die. But with the gaming universe, you could potentially have hundreds, thousands of people working on it for as long as, you know, they're making money off of it, essentially. So that prolific kind of it's just a complete step change, I think, in how fantasy works once you get into that.
Yeah, though I will say your use earlier of the word legendarium, which is the word that people use to describe the Tolkien corpus and its potentially extensible edges, of course, brings back older concepts, not just the Marvel Cinematic Universe or the Star Trek Cinematic Universe, but also the Arthurian legendarium, right? There's a long tradition of available story space, which might be multiply authored. Yeah,
that's absolutely true. And it's interesting in that regard that because we haven't talked at all about the kinds of fantasy that take place in these pre-existing legendaria. So Arthurian fantasy, of course, is a particular subgenre, a very fruitful one, and it is simply the latest incarnation of something that goes back literally thousands of years. And we could view if any fantasy that uses existing pantheons, for instance, either Greek pantheon or whatever, in a sense also is doing precisely that. So you're right, in that sense, textual fantasy has always already been there,
And the Thousand and One Nights is another legendarium, which borrows from Indian stories and Persian stories and, you know, changes its name and its shape. And
So that's true.
Yeah. So this is probably a great moment to turn, Anna, so the final step for home here is a category we call recallable books. So where we ask, you know, another book that you would recommend to listeners here that might relate to this conversation. So maybe there's something you want to sort of pull off the shelf. Is that, did you have a book in mind or?
When you asked me to think about that, I went through a number of contenders, and actually I'll settle on something. It's a collection of short stories published, I think, or collected at any rate, in 1977, I believe, called The Kingdoms of Elfin by Sylvia Townsend Warner.
Oh my God, I love that book. I love that book. Yeah.
So she's a British writer who's better known as the author of Lolly Willows, a 1920s novel about a woman who becomes a witch, essentially. But at the very end of her life, she wrote a series of stories, many of which were published in the New Yorker, I think, set in different, incredibly vividly realized, quote unquote, elfin kingdoms, which are modeled on actual, mostly European, but also sort of Ottoman and Near Eastern cultures. With the usual kind of distinction between elves or fairies and mortals, but the way she takes on those, what we think of as familiar tropes, is just so different from anything that anyone would expect. I think it's a kind of sui generis, kind of unique creation, and it's disturbing. So it's not a cuddly, fuzzy read by any means, but it is. It'll make you question your understanding of fantasy, I think. So I would recommend that.
That's so great. Thank you so much. I totally agree. I mean, maybe James Hogg would be the closest comparison, but, you know, 170 years after some of those strange fairy tales. But
Hogg is actually mentioned, I believe, in one or a couple of those stories.
Yeah, I think in the final
story,
maybe. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Cool. Elizabeth, you're going to pass this week, right? Or are you...
Well, I did occur. One did occur to me, which maybe I'll bring up, which is the Lloyd Alexander Taran series. I've forgotten the name of the series itself, but
Chronicles of Prydain, I think.
Chronicles of Prydain, yes. Yeah. That begins with the Book of Three, and I was thinking of it partly in relation to this idea of the legendarium, right? Because it's drawing on Welsh, sort of a Welsh. Yeah. World and also Welsh mythology. But, you know, that's one that I think it's a lot. I'm not sure it's as good as the Earth Sea Cycle, but
it's definitely not.
But it is.
I adore it.
And I love its, you know, the sort of way it has this kind of episodic character. Yeah. And there's the one of them, which is called Taran Wanderer. Which is a kind of very different in tone from the others, where the protagonist goes and he learns to first to weave and then to throw pots and then to forge a sword. And it has this very kind of detailed sort of production aspect. It's almost a little bit like
Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah, the Laura Ingalls Wilder, where there's like these descriptions, really kind of technical descriptions.
How to smoke a pig. Yeah,
exactly. I love that change of pace that it sort of allows.
Yeah. I just wrote a footnote about it, which I sort of compared the fact that Taran is the assistant pig keeper to the fact that that Ged begins as a goat keeper. Oh, and I talked about this kind of magic and manure quality, where it's like very earthy and very enchanted both. And I think that's something super endearing about those books. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that tradition of going back to the Welsh stuff, because, you know, that's not, he's not the only person to kind of reinvest the Mabinogian. Oh, so very quickly, I'll say I picked a book that often gets classified as science fiction, which is N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season. You'll see it in both. But I think, you know, she's clearly in conversation with Le Guin. And I really like Jemisin both because, you know, she's got this wonderful donné of a world where people can make or stop earthquakes with their minds. So that's sort of the magical power. But then she has a very sharp sense of how much what she's doing is not allegorical to our own world, but applicable in terms of the way that power works. And, you know, it belongs to that tradition of kind of geopolitical fantasy, I guess, where you learn a lot about who's in power and what you can do. Powering and othering, for sure. Yeah. Like, it turns out that basically people who can control earthquakes are the strongest people in the world, and that makes them the most abject because they need to be controlled by those who have real power, need to control the sort of earthquake minds. So yeah, it's a very resonant book, and then a series, but especially the first book I love. Okay, so I'm just going to add really quickly that for those of you who enjoyed these conversations, I think you'll want to tune in 2 weeks from now, where we're going to rebroadcast a conversation that we had years ago now with Madeline Miller, the author of Circe. And I also think you might like episode 46, when we spoke with children's lit expert Leah Price. And those are searchable, like all our archives, through our website or through the New Books Network. So, Anna, this has been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Recall This Book was founded by Elizabeth Ferry and me, John Plotz. It's sponsored by Brandeis and the Mandel Humanities Center. Sound editing is by Naomi Cohen. Website design and social media by Miranda Puri of the English Department. We're eager to hear your comments, criticisms, and thoughts. If you liked what you hear, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. From all of us here at RTB, thanks for listening.